We'll take a look at the markets and then ask, are they poisoned?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning to you and welcome to the Morning Open. I'm Bob Moon in for Bill Radke. Our look at the markets this morning will be prologue to a sharply worded new report we'll be exploring in a bit. That review concludes in no uncertain terms that the financial system has been poisoned by a bailout mentality. More on that shortly, but first things first, where's Wall Street? The Dow is off to a roaring start, up 192 points, which puts it back above the 10,000 mark by 92 points. That's a gain of roughly 2%. The S&P 500 is advanced by a similar margin, while the NASDAQ is up 1.75%. For a look at what's moving the markets out of the gate, we turn to our Thursday morning regular Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Good day.
Good morning.
How about these latest unemployment numbers just out, Diane? Weekly claims for jobless benefits dropped a bit, and the number of people staying on benefits also dropped. Wall Street seems to be seeing that as a hopeful sign that hiring is picking up. Do you?
Well, there is some glimmer of hope that hiring is picking up because the continuing claims dropped at their fastest pace in over a year. So there is sort of some credence to some modest hiring. The key word and operative word here is modest. And we're not going to see those unemployment claims come down to levels that would be comfortable for us for some time to come.
How does this fit with the numbers we saw last week?
It's really consistent with the numbers we saw last week. We're continuing to see about 140,000 rate on average monthly job growth now, which that's even though last month was a little weaker than that. We'll see it come back a bit. But it's nothing to write home about. It is we are generating jobs instead of firing. We've moved from that bloodletting to stabilizing, but we're still yet to see any major gains in job growth. And that's what we really need to see, the unemployment rate come down significantly.
The other big economic statistic out this morning was a tad wider U.S. trade deficit. That tracks how much stuff we're selling and buying from abroad. What do you think those numbers say about the global recovery?
Well, you know, what they show is that the recovery is coming back. We're up on both imports and exports from a year ago, and trade has resumed. That said, more recent data from China in May shows that China's demand for imports, our exports to China, will be falling off as we move into the summer months. These data are very lagged for the U.S., and it also suggests that China's really not broken its addiction to exports. So they're going to be looking for us to absorb some of their growth as they slow down, and that's just not a sustainable pattern going forward. We really need China to step up and the economies of the world to stop relying on the U.S. as the importer of last resort.
Mesirow Financial Chief Economist Diane Swonk, appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Morning Report for Thursday, June 10th at marketplace.org. Today's the one-year anniversary of the day Chrysler joined Italian carmaker Fiat and emerged from a quick bankruptcy. Chrysler hopes a new version of an old favorite can help it in the year ahead. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
By the time Fiat took over Chrysler last year, the company didn't have any new vehicles in the pipeline. Alan Baum is an auto industry analyst, and he says Chrysler's been getting its act together over the last 12 months.
They've obviously righted the ship in terms of management and having a plan. Their product plan is a reasonable one going forward.
But Baum says it'll be at least a year before Chrysler gets a new model into showrooms, and he says more likely it'll take two or three. So the company's come up with an interim solution. It's going to relaunch one of its most popular brands, the Jeep Grand Cherokee. Dave Boulay is at PCG Campbell. It's a marketing firm that specializes in the auto industry. He says Chrysler's going to spend a lot of money promoting the brand.
Companies have to sell what they're making, and currently that's what they have.
Nobody expects that relaunching the Cherokee is going to turn the company around, but the SUV could help it hold on until it has some new models to sell. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Payday loans are short-term loans you can get in check cashing stores or even online. They cost a lot. So community organizers in Baltimore are trying to wean people off by forcing them into financial fitness classes. Kathy Duchamp reports.
Felix Torres Colon runs a nonprofit called Neighborhood Housing Services. The group wants to protect people from so-called predatory lending practices.
We're really kind of a bridge to get people more used to more normal practices and then hopefully graduate them to mainstream institutions.
Borrow and Save is a pilot loan program for Baltimore residents who Cologne says get caught in a cycle of taking a loan, then paying it back, then taking another loan.
Over and over and over again. They get in that cycle. The problem with robbing Peter to pay Paul, you're just really shifting deck chairs on the Titanic, so to speak.
A two-week cash advance loan carries an interest rate of around 30%. But if you don't pay it back on time, the rate can go up to 300% or more. That's the situation Daryl Witherspoon got in.
Yeah, it took me maybe 3-4 years to actually get caught up and clear of all of that.
Witherspoon was one of the first people to sign up for the Borrow and Save program. He got a $1,000 loan with an 8% interest rate. He had a year to pay it back. That's more time than he'd get with a payday loan at a fraction of the cost. But for Witherspoon, the biggest bang for the buck came from the mandatory financial fitness classes.
That was the best part of it, because I really didn't expect the counseling and tutoring financially that they gave.
Witherspoon learned the specific steps required to improve a credit score, like writing letters to credit reporting agencies to clarify a debt. He also learned the importance of paying yourself first.
So now I snatch $40 out of my pay, no matter what, going into a savings account, just to make sure, you know, I got a little extra that I don't need or don't touch.
Witherspoon has had to dip into his savings for some unexpected medical expenses. Still, he managed to pay off his loan from the Borrow and Save program in just 5 months, thanks to an income tax refund. Neighborhood Housing of Baltimore says it shows that people of little means are not necessarily bad credit risks. In Baltimore, I'm Kathy Duchamp for Marketplace.
The largest hospital walkout in U.S. history is set for this morning in Minnesota. 12,000 nurses are planning to strike for a single day in a challenge to the way hospitals are run. As Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports, it's a movement that could be going national.
Twin Cities nurses are striking over an idea imported from California. They want strict nurse-to-patient ratios. Minnesota already has some of the lowest ratios and best health outcomes in the country. But John Nemo of the Minnesota Nurses Association says nurses are overworked and distracted, and that's dangerous.
Our nurses want more ability and more power to decide how to staff the floors and how to care for the patients.
Their employers, the hospitals, say the arguments over patient safety are window dressing for more mundane contract battles. And hospital spokeswoman Maureen Schreiner says strict staffing ratios will do more harm than good.
Hospitals need to be nimble and flexible, and everything that the union is proposing is from a bygone era.
Schreiner says relations with nurses have deteriorated since Minnesota, California, and Massachusetts nurses' unions merged to form a so-called superunion in December. The union now covers 20 states and has made overworked nurses its signature issue. In St. Paul, I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
If you're looking for a recession-proof business, you'll want to cross prisons off the list. A number of correctional institutions have closed around the country since the start of the recession, and that's causing job losses in places where finding work is tough. Colorado Public Radio's Zachary Barr has the story.
Nancy Weir and her husband moved to Walsenburg, Colorado for the rural lifestyle. They wanted to have horses.
Three colts, and this is my old man, Willie.
The trouble is, now Nancy's living alone, so after a long nursing shift, there's still work to do.
Now I have to come home at midnight or 1 or 2 a.m. and still bring all the horses their grain and last feed for the day.
Nancy's husband, Jeff, would normally do these chores, but that was before he and nearly 200 others lost their jobs at the nearby private prison. To continue his career, Jeff decided to take a job at another for-profit prison in Oklahoma.
He left March 26th, the day after his birthday.
The Huerfano County Correctional Center here in Walsenburg shut down because it lost the contract to house Arizona inmates. Arizona recalled those 700 inmates into its state system to save money. And that decision left Bonnie Rose without a job as a correctional officer.
I thought that I would retire completely from there. I never thought at the age of 62 I'd be out wandering around looking for another job.
The rub is, prisons aren't quite as full as they once were.
The state prison population has dropped for the first time in nearly 40 years.
Adam Gelb is with the Pew Center on the States. He says the drop is partly due to the fact that states need to cut their budgets. But he says it's also because many lawmakers and politicians now feel it's okay to send fewer people to prison.
More and more policymakers are realizing there are research-based strategies that can produce public safety at far less cost than a $25,000 a year taxpayer-funded prison cell.
But tell that to the folks in Walsenburg. Here on Main Street, cars zoom by numerous empty storefronts where Nancy LeVay owns a gift shop. She says business is way down since the prison closed, and she doesn't see it turning around easily.
It would have to take something very major to replace the prison, and we don't have any idea of what that would be right at the present time.
In Walsenburg, Colorado, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
Congress is working to approve a package of unemployment benefits, business tax breaks, and aid to states before July 4th. In an effort to reduce the bill's impact on the budget deficit, lawmakers are proposing to slap a stiff tax on investment fund managers. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Right now, income earned by managers of private equity or real estate investment funds is taxed as capital gains, which means 15%. Ordinary income is taxed at as much as 39% for those in the highest brackets. Treating investment managers' take as ordinary income would bring in $18 billion to help pay for unemployment benefits. And that's fine with Nicole Tishon at U.S. PIRG, who says it's not a tax hike.
We see this more as closing a loophole and having investment fund managers pay the same tax rate as similarly situated workers.
But equity fund managers say the higher taxes will hurt the economy. And Missouri's Republican Senator Christopher Bond agrees.
This is designed to cut the ability of venture capital groups to put together the money that you need for researchers or inventors who are creating jobs.
Supporters of the tax change say the fact that the bill has a good chance of passing this year shows how investment bankers have lost political clout since the financial crisis. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Now on to that report that we talked about from a congressional watchdog panel, which is blasting the government's 2008 rescue of insurance giant AIG. The Bush administration signed off on that plan, which was engineered by Timothy Geithner, who's now President Obama's Treasury Secretary. The Congressional Oversight Panel says the $182 billion bailout distorted financial markets by sending a message to taxpayers that they'll pay any price and bear any burden to prevent the collapse of America's largest financial institutions. Joining me now is Harvard Professor Elizabeth Warren, who chairs the panel that issued this report. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've heard a lot of philosophical debate about the risk of creating a moral hazard with these bailouts. Now your panel says that's exactly what the result has been. But I wonder if arriving at that conclusion isn't something like what Justice Potter Stewart said when the Supreme Court ruled on obscenity, hard to define, but I know it when I see it. Or do you see this as more clear cut?
Actually, I think this one is a lot more clear cut. Remember even what happened in Bear Stearns when the New York Fed and the Treasury were able to lend money to J.P. Morgan Chase so that it could purchase Bear Stearns, but very important private participation in that. When we hit the AIG problem, there's a real moral hazard when you say the government does an entire rescue, funds it all, and puts it all on the taxpayer.
Well, the Treasury Department begs to differ. A spokesman there says that you've overlooked the basic fact that the global economy was on the brink of collapse. And that pretty closely parallels what Treasury Secretary Geithner defended the bailout with. Here's how he put it back in January. He said he engineered this deal to prevent the utter collapse of the U.S. economy.
We acted because the consequences of AIG failing would have been catastrophic for our economy and for American families and businesses.
So, Professor Warren, what about that?
No one overlooked it, but I want to be clear. If the Federal Reserve had taken a closer look at what was happening with AIG earlier, we might not have been in the position of a 100% bailout.
What about what Treasury is saying, that we've learned from this experience that they've tried to come up with a way of reversing this moral hazard?
Absolutely. Our report comes in the context of a large national debate on the question of regulatory reform. You know, someday there will be another Treasury Department that will face a crisis of this magnitude. There's a real advantage to looking through what happened in the AIG circumstances so that maybe the people who face that crisis will keep those options in mind.
Elizabeth Warren chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
There's word today that the new British Prime Minister, David Cameron, is likely to confer by phone with President Obama this weekend, and a spokesman for the British government says BP will be discussed. That's amid signals from U.S. officials that the administration is going to increase its oversight of the oil giant and its actions in the Gulf. And finally this morning, listen carefully now to the gap it would leave by making one of the most famous nicknames in automotive history disappear.
Bye-bye, Miss American Pie, drove much to the levee.
Now, if you weren't already singing along, I'm betting you filled in the name subconsciously, which makes you wonder about a story in today's New York Times. The paper got a hold of an internal memo from that car maker with the three-syllable name, urging employees at its Detroit headquarters to stop using its two-syllable nickname. Now, since the shorthand is already hardwired into everybody's consciousness, it raises the question, is this for real? The Times notes the car maker is still using the nickname all over its website, and a spokesman at General Motors confirms this supposed change is linked to the company's new advertising agency, which explains why I haven't been using the name. Could this actually be a well-floated publicity ploy? I'm just saying. I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.